You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 100. I'm Jessica Yaquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about the Bolivar Archaeological Project. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch or Ute Peoples Treaty Lands, the Dene Tah, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. So today we have Ms. Betty Kimball and Mr. Howard Clark on the show, and they are going to introduce themselves. Ms. Kimball?
Okay, I'm Betty Kimball, and I don't know whether you want me to tell now, I was related to Tom Cook, but he was my great-grandfather. And about this project, the first time that I heard about it was through Maria. She was the one that contacted me and told me what they were doing. And so that's how I got involved with it, found out. And I found out more about Tom Cook than I'd ever heard about. And he was my great-grandfather. And then Maria contacted me and we got to talking about it, and I'm learning so much about Tom Cook that I'd never heard before, but it's a blessing.
Yeah. Mr. Clark?
I'm Howard Clark. I'm Tom Cook's great-grandson.
And how did you first hear about the project?
Maria Franklin first contacted my family, Aunt Betty, and my youngest daughter. And they were busy, and they eventually just asked me if I was interested in, helping or being involved with the project. And I started out by being a landscaper for the company. I took some tools out and I helped them trim and clean up this one of the locations. And it just led to more involvement. I had to teach Dr. Miniker how to use a weed eater. And it just grew from there. But Maria was my first contact. She contacted me on the phone and talked to me about it. I had no idea about it.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm super excited to have you both on the show. Super honored. What I was saying to Doug beforehand was used to having people working on history and not people that have made history on the podcast. So this is pretty cool and different. And also, I think you guys might be the first direct descendants of an archaeology project that we've had on the show. So that's very cool. But so could you tell me a little bit more about like those first interactions with Maria, like what she told you about what was happening and what your kind of first reaction was to hearing about all of this?
Yeah, when they first contacted me and they told me about what they were doing, they were digging where Tom Cook's blacksmith shop was and they found so many artifacts, and that was surprising. Back in the 1800s, like a button and a marble. And they explained to me, what year those things were. And it was just so amazing to me. And I wanted to learn more. And I'm learning more, constantly about what Tom Cook did. And his grave is over in Bolivar right now.
Oh,
Yeah, his grave. Howard took a picture and showed me up the grave, Tom Cook. And I guess two of the children that were killed in the storm that they had over there, we don't know if they're where their graves are, but I'm sure they were buried in Bolivar. And they found my father, Homer, and the cousin, Grace, in the field after the storm, but it killed two of their siblings.
I had no clue. Like I said, I'd heard the Cook name before, but I hadn't even really associated that with, I knew about the Clarks. They were just down the road, supposedly on another ranch, but I didn't know anything about the Cook. I'd heard of Jack Cook, Tom's son, but I never put two together that he was actually a relative, of mine. I was in that lineage. I just knew he was a guy that married into somebody that we knew. But anyway, from my first contact was that they were widening the highway. They found some land or property that my ancestors or somebody in my family may have been previous owners of. And they were actually excavating and looking for, you know, artifacts or whatever. It was interesting to me. So, yeah, I'd help. I still at that point didn't know how attached I was to it or how, because I used to patrol that area for the sheriff's department. I used to hunt in that area. I knew about, like I said, the Craver Ranch down the road where the Clarks, after they got to this area, came from, or that area. But I didn't know anything about the Cooks. Now I understand, because they were just right up the road from each other, 2 to 3 miles separated them. So that's how they, I guess, came together. But it opened my eyes to a whole lot of stuff after the initial contact. And then I realized, like, oh, that's where I'm actually related to the Cook. We did go see the gravesite, my youngest daughter and I. And he was also involved with something that I was involved in, the blacksmithing part, that I knew wasn't hereditary, but I didn't know that I even had that anywhere in my family history. That made it twice as interesting right off the bat. So that's how I stayed with it.
Yeah, the Clarks. Kitty married Glasgow Clark. So that's how the Clark got in with Tom Cook's family. Cook's daughter, my grandmother, married Glasgow Clark, and they had 7 children. And my daddy was one of the 7 children that Kitty and Glasgow had. Mm-hmm.
And do you ever remember your grandmother talking about her dad?
Really? I was 8 when she passed. But I remember Daddy and Mother would be at work. They worked at the colleges of North Texas and Texas Women University. And they would get in at night. So Mama, that's Kitty, would put, she had a rocking chair, and she'd put Bubba, that's Howard's daddy. We called him Bubba. And on one side, and I sit on the other side. And she'd sing to us at night of some kind of hymn or something, and rocking in the rocking chair. And I was 8 when she passed, but I remember Mama real well.
Yeah.
She was born, well, Tom Cook was her daddy. And so, but, you know, we didn't talk about the past like that. You know, we just took it for granted. We were here, and Mama was Tom Cook's daughter. And now I'm learning more now than I did when I was a child coming up.
How is that to learn more now? How does
that know about all of this? And I'm so glad that being at my age, 93, finding about all of this before I leave this earth. So it's a blessing for me to know all of this now. And then I can pass it on to my daughter and the grandchildren.
Yeah. Is there, for each of you, is there like something that you learned that really stood out to you, like a particular the story or part of the experience that really was special for you?
Right now, all of it's just so exciting to me. Just that all of it is just special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just the fact that it was. I mean, I had a great-great-grandfather that, you know, we still know his name now, and took me back further than the 1 or 2 generations I was aware of. Everything about it was interesting to me because it all pertains to me. I say, you know, not me specifically, but I come from that. So everything, every aspect of it. Yeah, the fact that he was a blacksmith and we have that kind of, for whatever it is, drew us into it, was very interesting. That struck a chord, obviously, and made it more intense, I guess. But just the fact that I know a little bit more about my history than a lot of black folks do about, you know, maybe 1 or 2 generations back. I mean, there's a lot of speculation maybe, but now I have some concrete evidence or proof of who I came from, you know. But now the sad aspect of it is it makes you want to know more and want to go back even further. You know, I want to know where his wife came from, because that's still part of my family, and what it was like, where he came from when he was enslaved, where was it? I'd like to see the plantation if it still exists. Or the family that supposedly owned, if you will, you know, the family. It creates a whole lot more questions, and some of the stuff I know probably will never just don't have access to. But there's still going to always, I'm satisfied with what is, but there's still going to always be that empty space where I wish I could fill in.
Yeah. Yeah. So could the two of you tell us about Mr. Tom Cook and Ms. Lethea Cook?
Well, I have a white friend that went and found out all of this, and he told us about it. But I don't know, and I do have some material about when Liddy and Tom Cook married. Mm-hmm. And they were in the Carolinas. And what I would like to find out, how did they get over here in America from Africa?
Yeah, that's
what I don't know. That's what I would love to know. So I'm going to keep digging, see if I can find out when they came from, I guess, Africa as slaves. Mm-hmm. And I guess the slave owner must have been pretty good to them for them to come from Carolina to Fort Worth and from Fort Worth to Bolivar. And to me, they weren't treated like slaves. He had this blacksmith shop. People looked up to him. All the outlaws would come with their horses and wagons, and he worked on them. And everybody looked up to Tom Cook. And then I would love to know what Tom Cook looked like, because the two uncles that, I mean, two sons that was around when I was born, they were little short men. And Mama, that was Mama's brother, her grandmother's brother. So I would love to know more, I mean, you know, something about Tom Cook. Now I know, and his wife too, her people. And how did they meet in Africa, wherever they from, to the States? That's the part I'd like to know. I want to keep digging and see if I can find out more about that.
I assume they were born here, probably. I don't know what generation. That's another question again. But who were their grandparents? Like Aunt Betty was asking, when they actually came to America, or were they? Because from what I understand, when they got to Tarrant County, they were already free, or had been free, if that makes sense. Yeah. No, they hadn't? No, I was thinking when they, by the time they got to Tarrant County, well, that doesn't make sense. 1865 would have been, yeah. So, but by the time they got to up to Bolivar, obviously they were 1870-ish.
And you know, they ended up in Fort Worth. And then it was more Clarks in Fort Worth. I was in college and I sung in the choir, and we traveled. And we stayed, you know, then you didn't have hotels and motels to stay in. You had to stay. Well, we spent the night with a Clark in Fort Worth. And he was real light-skinned, very sweet man, he and his wife. So, because their grandson was in the choir with us, in the college choir. So I'm sure they were Clarks too. And that's where Tom Cook them came from, Fort Worth in Clark. So I'm just wondering, were they kin folks?
Yeah.
And, you know, now it's just coming back then, you know, it was just Clark, you just a Clark, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm in college and I wasn't thinking about who was who, you know, during that time. Mm-hmm. But now I'm wanting to see, where did they come from? How did they? All these different Clarks. And then we had a neighbor Clark down the street from us that it was a Clark, but they said they were no kin. So there's three different, I know it was about four different Clarks, but we weren't kin folks. But they all came from the southern states, like the Carolinas to Texas. So it had to be some connection somewhere in there.
My college teammate and roommate, Tiny, he was a Clark, and he came from Tennessee. His Clarks came from Tennessee. Somewhere I thought I'd heard one time, they said that some of us had come from through that area. but just ran into each other in college, and we've been friends ever since. But that we thought that was odd, and he somewhat resembles. I don't know. I'd like to know, you know, where he. I think his only living family is in Georgia now, but that was another kind of a curiosity that was weird. But the main thing now is I'd like to know what it was like to transition from enslavement to free. Do you just walk off and start on your own, or, you know, because you could very likely get killed just walking down the road back then for what it looked like. But how do you negotiate that? I'm free now, I can do what I want to, but it wasn't like all the hate went away. So you then to take care of your family, take care of yourself, then become an owner of a business of your own. I guess you just probably had to keep your mouth shut and work and just not, but he was a pastor and a Freemason and everything. So he was very active.
He could read, but he couldn't write.
In a time where you weren't supposed to basically do anything. That's why I tell a lot of youngsters nowadays, there's no excuse for you not making it. Because, you know, you can go to the same library, you can eat in the same cafeteria, you go to the same school, you get the same books, you got the same teachers. And you don't have that excuse anymore that, because this man made it from absolutely when you were not supposed to. And yeah. I'm sure during those times you were not supposed to, and they would tell you why you weren't supposed to. There was no shame of the, you know, the hate, or they didn't try to hide it. They didn't have to. Right. And he still won. Right. So that's, if I were to say proud, that's where the pride would come from, is the fact that he didn't just lay down and go back to the plantation. He went ahead and stayed out and did it on his own and made it. And then saw that his family made it. And apparently that, whatever you call it, was instilled enough in the family to keep it pushing forward. And I don't know of any bad apples. I'm sure there was some somewhere, but they all seemed to have done pretty well after him. You know, preachers, business, work, owned property, owned houses, doing better than a lot of us nowadays. So that I would, if I could ask him anything, I'd like to know how he made it, do this and stay alive simply during that time.
Yes, something I'd like to know too, how did Kitty and Glasgow get together? Where did they marry? You know, because when they came from the Carolinas to Fort Worth, they had children. Hmm. 7 children. Hmm. But where did they get together? Get together in the Carolinas, Africa, or where? That's the point.
Sometimes the Clarks. May have come, the Clarks may have come to Tennessee or from Tennessee.
Well,
or,
somebody told me one time, one lady was looking up all of this, that Glasgow came from Tennessee, but here, a few years later, we heard he came from the Carolinas.
Yeah, that's what,
that was Kitty's husband, Glasgow.
Yeah.
And he was, you could tell he was mixed.
He was part black, part white.
Mm-hmm. And my college roommate, who said his family came from Tennessee, he's a Clark.
Uh-huh.
Tiny's kind of lighter. You can tell it wasn't far back, probably when there was some.
So I guess when the Clarks came over, I know they had to get the name from their slave owner, the Clark. And it must have been a bunch of Clarks, some in Tennessee and some in the Carolinas.
That's kind of the void, I think, is going to be hard to fill. Because
you don't know which way to get.
Yeah, and there's no definite way. Like we do back to Tom Cook, we know that. I mean, we know who he is. We saw people that came from him, and he's right on down the line. But yeah. I guess if we went all the way back to the day they stepped off the ship, then we'd want to know where his family was in Africa and what they looked like and what tribe they were. You know, there's never really an end to it, but I've learned a whole lot more in the last, 2-3 years since
what we gathered, they didn't have a hard time, so they must have had some good slave owners. Because from what we hear, they had a good life, a good, easy life. And Tom Cook, I guess he learned all from whoever raised him about the blacksmith. And people looked up to him.
Well, from what I understand, what they would tell us, like on the plantation down in Louisiana, the blacksmiths, the skilled, the guys that could run the cotton gins and the equipment of those types were paid more or sold for more than the field hands, or I guess what's the modern term for it, unskilled or whatever. Some, I want to say maybe even the cooks or the housekeepers were maybe a little more, but the blacksmiths and the skilled operators were, they had a name for it, but probably the most, well, they were the most expensive, I mean, the most prized, I guess you'd say. So I guess whoever taught him to do that also increased his value, too, I mean, as far as being able to. There was an ultimate plan that always came back to the owner, I'm sure, you know. But when he was, sometimes I hear people try to spin it, well, they thought so much of him when the end was coming, they turned him, gave him the skill and send him loose. And it's kind of like, nah, that's still a way of trying to grab some credit for it yourself. And I'm like, nah, he did that because that was something, another task that the owner didn't have to do. Train somebody well, and but now, yeah, it did apply when he got on his own, and that brought him more money to his farm if he had a guy that could fix and repair.
Yeah.
So, but it, and God's blessing turned it into a blessing for Tom once he was on his own.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, we are already at our first break point, and we will be right back here in a second. Okay. So we are back from our break, and I am really interested to hear more about the experience of going to the site, the archaeology site. So, Mr. Clark, you mentioned starting with some landscaping work that the archaeologist didn't know how to do. What, from there, what was it like working on the project? What kind of things were you doing?
Well, it was interesting, but most of it was, I was just kind of the grunt work. Would haul and sift through the, you know, the artifacts, through the sand, through the dirt. Any setup or help with setup, any, I mean, they kind of like go here, do that, lift this, put that over there, stand this here, which was, you know, all fine, but it just, because I didn't know, I still don't necessarily know anything about archaeology other than what I've seen them do. But the most part, I mean, the most interesting part was just seeing things that I knew were, you know, maybe 100 years old or older. And that seeing stuff that other folks did before me, you know, I knew not to touch, mess with. As a matter of fact, I've learned a new respect for artifacts, because, you know, when you do find them, I won't say that I necessarily leave them where they are, but I understand the importance of it. Now, it makes a whole lot more sense to me. And I learned a lot more about archaeologists than I just thought these were going to be scientists that had nothing to do with us. They were going to be stiff and rigid and do this, do that. But they were like actually human. And so, I mean, you know, it was actually educational, but it was fun also. It wasn't, it was a lot better than just textbook only. I think if kids or students or whatever else had the opportunity, they ought to see that part of it. I don't know if you could do that first, but very early on, because that would definitely keep your attention. You know, the first time you pick something up and go, you know, wow, somebody however long ago held this in their hand, and here I am now, you know, showing it, bringing it to the light again. But it was very interesting. I mean, I wasn't in as good a shape as I thought I was in, but, you know, that work was kind of hard. I got a newfound respect for them that way, too, especially the getting down in the little sections where they would dig and scrape. And that I didn't do because I just wouldn't fit and my knees wouldn't let me, but there's a lot of hard work, but it yields a whole lot also.
Are there any specific artifacts that really stood out to you?
Well, the knives, even the little parts of flatware, plates, you know, the crockery, the dishes, and for them to be able to go, oh, well, that's a, you know, spongeware from, you know, whatever century or whatever year that, you know, they can tell you that looking at it. I was impressed, but there was somewhere in there, there was a wedding band found.
Oh, wow.
And I, you know, without knowing, obviously, who is it, one that my great-great-grandfather lost? Was he fixing it for something? And I don't know, but that was personal. you know, and then the knives, like I said, that was kind of what I was interested in, of what they looked like, or what a lot of folks have in their mind that back in the day, everybody carried a Bowie with a big bronze or brass hilt and stag handle. And most of the time, if you got down to it, the guys, if you want to know what they really made it with, it looked about like your Chicago cutlery butcher knife. But that's what, and that's what kind of what we found, just basic, real people, normal folk stuff. The marbles, that means that there was kids probably around. One thing that stuck in my mind, and I found it was Stone Age, the awl that I found, it, you could tell it had been worked. It was chert or whatever stone. And Doug said that, you know, even back then, during Tom Cook's time, those folks collected that sort of stuff too when they found it. Or I guess potentially it could have been an older site than we thought too. You know, who knows how it got there, but most likely something that they had. You know, that was weird to me. I mean, I've always looked for, I've only found one arrowhead in my life that I know of. And that would have been the second stone artifact like that I've ever found. And it was right in my great-great-grandfather's spot. You know, so I don't know where it came or how it got there, but who made it. But that, I remember that probably as much or more than anything else.
Yeah, yeah. It's very cool with, like, how, you know, people 100 years ago were basically the same as we are today, you know, found the same kind of things. Cool.
Well, you expect to find horseshoes and, you know, too. I mean, it was still neat, but to find stuff like the wedding band and the, there was a piece of a pocket knife, but it was just stuff that, you know, ordinary people had that you didn't think about. That was, you know, was this in his pocket? Did he lose it here? Did he leave it here? And like, just when he passed away. Yeah, it just leads into more questions.
And Ms. Kimball, were you also able to visit the site, the archaeology site?
We went one Saturday. They had us all to come and see the artifacts that they had found, and they had them on display, and that was really interesting to see. I never did remember seeing the wedding.
Yeah, it was there. I don't know where
it was. I know they said it was there, but I don't remember seeing it. But the things that we did see, it was amazing to see, like marbles and buttons and the little things that they found. It was just, and then the year. Yeah. They even told the year that these things were used, what year they were used in, way back in the 1800s.
Well, that button off of a uniform, that was another thing. It was a Union? Yeah, Union soldier, and of course, Danny, I wonder how it came across. You know, did he, well, I don't know, we talked about that. Was it like surplus from, was y'all three? I couldn't remember. I know I saw one, for sure. Well, I know it was one, yeah, I do remember. But, you know, they didn't have Army surplus stores, I don't think, after. But it was just a jacket probably after that. It didn't, you know, it just came across it somehow. But down here, I don't know if wearing that would have been popular at that time, but that the old and then finding the pork bones and the ammo, spent ammo and rounds. And I wondered if the blacksmith shop wasn't also like a butcher shop, or you know, you did whatever you needed to do there. As far as, and that brought back memories of me and my dad butchering pigs back there behind our place.
Yeah,
still in the family.
The blacksmith shop was close to the hotel too, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
they had a hotel
right across the road.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of stuff that was.
So that's when the outlaws would come through. They would go and stay at the hotel, you see.
Yeah. I guess Baltimore was a booming little town for a little while, until the railroad, I think, and the fire.
And was it a saloon there in the hotel? Was it a saloon in the hotel?
I don't remember if it was. I think there was more than one watering hole there, wasn't there?
It was amazing to find out how they, you know, the things that they lived through during that time.
One of the things that they thought were luxury, out like that well and the hotel, and of course it could have been butchering the pig right across the way and bringing them over to the hotel. Who knows? I don't know how that happened. But yeah, there was a lot of interesting stuff that came out, and some of it I recognize from things we still do, and then some of it you wonder, well, what was this for? You know, why the little axe or the little hatchet I thought it was a kid's, like somebody forged it for a child, you know, this little hatchet. But Kelly told us it was a sugar axe. It used to, I think he said salt too, but sugar would come in a little cone compressed together. And you'd use that little axe to like chop off little pieces of lump sugar. I'd never even heard of anything like that. I just would have said, oh, this must be a kid's, you know, hatchet, tomahawk or something made by dad or forged out maybe by my grandpa, great-great-grandpa. But it was a sugar axe.
Huh. That's cool. How did the archaeologists connect in with the community? How did it come about?
I think that just grew from curiosity, too, and the desire to get it out to the community and get support, and because there was obviously an interest in it. I know when I came home, everybody, even now, they're still asking. They want to know where the website, where can they see it? Well, that's, you know, and they're still talking about it. But when they actually started to show up and see it, I think that the biggest part was that Doug and Alex and, well, everybody was, they were very approachable and knowledgeable, but not, they didn't talk over anybody's head. They will explain. Doug would walk off the site and when people would drive up, and some of them were a little surly, you know, I would say, you know, like, well, y'all looking for dinosaurs? No, we're not looking for dinosaur bones, but I probably wouldn't have had the patience that Alex and Doug did with some of them. And I mean, I'm kind of from the area, and you know who certain types of people are. And but they would take time to explain and talk to and be patient, and there was a lot of interest in it. And like I said, they didn't treat it like it was a secret scientific project. They talked a lot to just anybody that showed up.
Yeah, I loved that part of the articles and different things talking about people just stopping by and, you know, doing outreach just kind of as it came instead of...
Some guy dropped off a bag of fossils, I think, one day. From what I understand, his little attitude when he dropped it off was like, you know, that's not what we're doing. Yeah, well, anyway, I didn't interact with any of those folks. I mean, it's hard work. Even the sifting was hard, but it was because every bucket full, you knew there was going to be some little something. And then sometimes you'd get one of those, oh, man, look, you know, or... It was always, well, what is this? And some things, you know, you would recognize, and you would be surprised at how much you do recognize back from that time. But it was a swing full of dirt or soil or whatever. There was always something new, you know, from the blacksmith, from scale or clinker and stuff, you know, the byproducts of blacksmithing to, you know, artifacts, you know, a little tool or a little button, a little marble. Pieces of flatware, all kinds of things.
Yeah. Wow. And before we get too far away from it, I want to ask about the oral history part of the project. So this was Dr. Maria Franklin. And so what did she do? How did you guys participate in the oral history part of the process?
Well, we were interviewed, like I think they told you, and then they had us interview other folks that we knew and folks that were part of the community and family. I think that worked real well because a lot of us knew the same things or had heard the same stories or knew some of the same people or some things I'd either forgotten or didn't remember the way, you know, whatever, my cousin or whoever I interviewed would pick up and remember names that I had forgotten. It just kind of all worked together. That was actually a smart move to put us talking to each other. Mm-hmm. Because it was just like sitting around the house explaining or remembering, you remember this, remember that? Oh, yeah, this is where Miss So-and-so. A lot of information that I either didn't know or would have forgotten, especially with Aunt Betty and the ones that are before us, you know, because I can remember only so far, but Aunt Betty and, you know, the ones that they take it back, Miss Alma, Clark, Ruby, they could take it back a lot further. And a lot of names I've heard but didn't necessarily know the people. But it worked out real well. And they just kind of let us talk. You know, it wasn't too hard.
Did she like do any sort of like training with you guys, like on how to do it with other people? Like,
There was some structure to it, but it wasn't, I mean, if I could do it, then it wasn't that much. But yeah, I mean, she kind of told us the things we can say, need to say, you know, how to make sure we had the legal parts covered, but and some of the things that we needed to get in. But other than that, it was kind of low pressure. You know?
Yeah.
She was kind of a task driver, but, you know. No, it was good. It was fun. It was easy because they made us comfortable with it. Like I said, nobody was, I hadn't run into anybody yet that I didn't like or didn't get along with or didn't feel, you know, comfortable around.
But then when y'all finished digging and looking into everything, then that's when they had a few of us out there that Saturday morning, and you had a display of the artifacts that you had found. And that was the first time that we saw all of this. I think that was the first time y'all showed it. And that was really interesting to see what y'all did find.
And Ms. Kimball, was your interview for the oral history, was that before you saw the artifacts or was it after?
It was after they had found the artifacts.
Do you remember like the kinds of things that you talked about during your oral history interview?
Basically about the things that they found, and they would talk about the year that they put, like that little button they were talking about, the year of that. Whoever soldier wore this little button. And they pretty well had the years of all of the things that they found back in the 1500s.
And when they talked to you about your family legacy, do you remember what you talked about?
Oh, yeah. Jack Cook and Kitty Clark were sisters and brothers. And then there was the one we called Uncle Bud, that was their brother too. And it was family that was left from the family was Aunt Dicey, that was Mama's sister, and the Jack and Bud, out of the seven children, siblings. But like I told you before, it was two that was killed in the storm. And that's where they buried Tom Cook, over there in Bolivar. And when they left Fort Worth, that's where they settled in Bolivar. And then from Bolivar to Quakertown. Well, when they got to Quakertown, it was so full, it was nowhere for them to stay right there in Quakertown. But it's just like, maybe a two or three blocks from Quakertown was this house. And now it's called the Women's Building. And that's where Mama, well, Kitty in Glasgow stayed when they left Bolivar. Because it was nowhere in Quakertown for them to stay. So they stayed in this little house, and that house is still there. It's called the Women's Building now. And then after that, because we would go to Aunt Dice's house, walk from Lakey Street to Aunt Dice's house some morning, Mama, me, and Bubba, and we'd go sit on Aunt Dice's porch on Congress Street. They moved from that little house to Congress Street. And then this was after Tom Cook, he died, and then that was after Tom Cook was dead. When he died, they sold the blacksmith shop, Mama and her mother and husband. And that's when they moved to Quakertown. Tried to move to Quakertown, but they stayed in the little house, which was just maybe a block away from Quakertown. And then they stayed with Aunt Dice and them until they built the house on Lakey Street.
Well, the two that got killed in the storm, those are Clarks. Those two that got killed in the storm, those were Clarks.
Yeah, those were Clarks. Those were Mama's two children that was killed in the storm. Yeah. And then when they moved, they had Daddy and Uncle Buddy and Jewel. It wasn't but three more kids. And then Jewel died. She had a nail stuck in her foot and died from that. And her grave is down there in Denton with Mama and Lesko. And then
How many would Tom Cook see doing? I'm getting mixed up.
Tom Cook?
Yeah. He.
Mama Uncle had Dad. Them. It was seven of them, and then Mama had seven kids, too.
Oh, okay.
So
Tom had seven?
Hmm. 11.
Oh, yeah, 11? Okay.
11. 11. Okay. Tom had 11, but Mama had seven.
Okay.
And I've got, where I live at the park, I've got all their names.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
In the years that they were born and when they died.
Okay. Daddy Homer had him, Uncle Buddy, and I don't remember all
of them. And Jewel. Those were the three that was living when they moved to.
Okay.
Both.
And then the two got killed in the storm.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. But from the storm, and they found Homer, my daddy. And then the first cousin, Gracie, in the field, and they were just like 2 months old. And then the other two was killed in the storm.
Mm-hmm.
That was in Boston. I don't think we've had any storm like that since then.
Not directly.
Not in then. Mm-hmm. You get to understand what I was saying?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. And it's crazy how fast it goes, but we are already at our second break point. But I'm excited to hear more when we come back here in a second.
Okay. So I'm very excited in this last segment that we have with Ms. Kimball and Mr. Clark. Ms. Kimball, I would really love to hear about your work with the Denton Women's Interracial Fellowship before we finish talking about this project, the archaeological project. So could you tell us a little bit about what that experience was like for you?
Oh, yeah. It was wonderful. It was the black and white we would meet. The ones that had children, when they started, had to go to the white schools, the black children, when they were going to close the I'll finish with Fred Douglas, and then in 49, they named it Fred Moore. But anyway, when they were going to close at the high school, for the blacks, and they had to go to the white high school. Well, you know, the children didn't want to do that at all. But the mothers, the white mothers and the black mothers, formed this organization. And we would go from home to home once a month to meet to try to get things straightened out where our children could transfer from the black school to the white school. Well, the children didn't want this. And they had a fit that they had to leave their school and go. But what we did, we would meet every week, and then we formed a committee. Oh, and one of the judges' wives, we went to their house very often. Judge Boyd, his wife, they had a teenager at that time, too. But anyway, we would meet and talk about the things what we could do to help our children transform from where they were to over to the white school. So we would take two or three of us would get together and go to the restaurants, the hotels, things that the blacks couldn't go to. What we did, I told them yesterday, me and this Ella Margaret, they assigned us to go to the Holiday Inn. And we went. I was a nervous wreck. But we did go. And they took our order. I mean, they set us down in the restaurant, took our order. Nobody paid us any attention. And so we ordered and we ate. And we left, no trouble at all. But when my brother got out of service, he was in the Navy. He and I went to, I think it was over there on Mulberry.
Foster.
We went to a drive-in restaurant and ordered a hamburger. The girl took our order. So we sit there and waited. Then she came back and said, I'm sorry, but we can't serve y'all because y'all black. Now, he'd been to the service in the Navy, for our country and then couldn't come back home and order a hamburger. Oh boy, I'm telling you, I was so upset. I said, if I had a gun, I'd shoot somebody. That's the way I felt. But we left, and do you know, in 2 months, that place had closed.
Yeah, karma.
Compatriots.
Well, we finally got the children over at the White High School, and they didn't want to go. And then when they did get there, the teachers made a difference with them. They wanted to put them in special ed. And we had smart kids. And we had some good black teachers. And the material that we had to get from the white school, some of the books would be raggedy, written all in. But anyway, we got them the football equipment that the football boys had to use, old used stuff. But do you know, we made it. They ended up with the football team winning all the games because the black boys was playing on the, you know, football. And I had a time getting my daughter to finish. She didn't want to go, but I made sure she finished. She didn't want to, but she did finish. And the ones behind her. And then another thing. The white girls was liking the black boys. Yep. Because, some of them was dating. You know, slipping and dating. But they made it through. And it wasn't anything that, you know, happened because they all grew up and most of them finished high school. And things started getting a little better then. Well, Trudy Foster was one of the members that worked with us. We couldn't go to the city council with anything. Trudy would be our spokesman. And she would go to the whatever we had to talk about, needed help on, we'd tell Trudy, and she'd go to the city council and work it out for us. Well, our streets was, when it would rain, would be just muddy. And we had to walk in the mud and the rain. Trudy and a group of us would go and get signatures. And Trudy would take them to the city council. That's how we got the streets paved over in Southeast Denton. But Trudy was a blessing. She helped us because we didn't have no spokesmen, but she was our spokesman for the Southeast Denton neighborhood. That's what part we stayed in, Southeast Denton. So, and we would have picnics in the summer and then have a Christmas party, the blacks and the white ladies. That was part of our, you know, organization. And it's still going on, but it's not active now. The year before last, Mabel Devereaux got together with what few is still alive and had a big Christmas dinner up to the First Methodist Church. And no, that's been 3 years ago. So the Christian women is alive, but we're not doing anything. But every fifth Tuesday, we have a meeting. We still do that every fifth, and it's four in a year. And we go to different churches. Now, we went last week to the First Methodist Church, and it wasn't but 16 there. I mean, white and black. I think it was about four or five of us black and then the rest of them, the white ladies. And it's supposed to be every church in Denton would have a representative. And we would have like 20 or 25. But now it's getting where, I don't know where they did or what, but they weren't there Tuesday. It was, like I said, it was only 16 of us there. But the organization is still, they haven't stopped, you know. And they told us, and we have a black president, Betty Fox. She's the president now. And what we're trying to do, they're going to send out letters in the churches too to get the ladies to start back meeting again.
So when you first got started, obviously you were focused on the kids moving over into one school and getting along together and making sure it was a good situation for the kids. Mm-hmm. And then you worked on like getting the road paved. Were there any other projects that you all worked on together?
Well, the main thing was, oh yes, the Legion Hall. I forgot about that. The American Legion Hall. And the veterans built that building. And the city, I guess, let them have the land, and they built that building. And so it was, the building was in such bad shape. After Mr. Noble Hollins, he was one of the veterans, he kept that building so nice and clean. But when he died, it just came, oh God, it was terrible. The windows was broken. They used it as a bathroom, and it was just terrible. So we went to the mayor, Bob, what was his name at that time? He said they didn't want to spend no money on it. But we, us old ladies, got together, and we kept pestering. We could, at that time, we could go to the city council. And so we would go in groups, and they gave us $11,000 and cleaned up that building, the American Legion building.
Yeah.
And they bought all the furniture that we needed, and we had two bathrooms and the kitchen, and that's where they had everything. They had weddings there, they had church there, dances, parties. That was our community building. Mm. And it still is now, but it's under the city of Denton, the American Legion. But the veterans built it. That's where the name came, the American Legion Hall. Veterans built that building. And it's under the city of Denton. And I was the director there for 15 years. But I worked for the city 20. And I started volunteering at Martin Luther King Center after I left TI. I worked TI 21 years, and when I left there, well, I started volunteering. And then when they got the American Legion building finished, well, the supervisor at Martin Luther King Center put me over the American Legion building, and I stayed there 15 years, and I retired in 2019. So, yeah, and oh, we had a good time. But do you know most of those people are dead?
Yeah.
That with me in those years. And it may be Miss Clark, she's 97, she's still with me. But it's very few of us still alive. But the Legion Hall is still going on.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's such an incredible story. Do you remember, like, who or how it all got started, like how this group of ladies came together originally?
Well, it was because of, like I said, the schools, you know, started changing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think Judge Bard's wife started it. Okay. He started getting us together. Judge Bard was the lawyer to some of the black folks. So anyway, they worked with us and started getting in touch with the children's parents, you know, calling us and sending us letters, and that's how it first started.
Wow. Okay. Because she had connections with both communities then?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. That makes sense. Wow. Wow. Well, like I said at the beginning, I talk to people who are studying history. I don't usually get to talk to people who are making it. So special to hear your story, and thank you for sharing.
And I have pictures of the group. I know it was about 16 black women that, you know, had children going to the, that was in high school. And like I said, we would go from each one of us homes, like first of the month, and have these meetings and try to work out things to integrate our children to the school, the black, the white school. And they still read more school now, but the high school. And that's where I think the children has been in trouble.
Like an alternative campus.
Yeah, alternative school.
I went there first grade.
You were a troublemaker in first grade?
No, it was still before they closed it. It was a church. It was still active then, but I don't know what year they actually closed it.
Oh, wait a minute.
It would have been 68 when I first started, first grade. Then mm-hmm.
Closed it in 60, I think it was 67 is
what in the 70s.
67 that they closed, because that was the last graduation.
Okay.
Reginald Logan graduated, he was class of 67, and then that was that. Melvin Cole was there for 3 weeks, he said, as a kindergartner, before they transferred him out.
Now I went to first grade because Mama was teaching high school there when I first started, but they moved. She went over to Robert E. Lee Elementary.
Yeah.
The next year, second grade, I went to Robert E. Lee Elementary.
And you were, that would have been 67, because you would have been, what, five?
Oh, I started when I was six.
See, so. I think they closed the school for a while. Fred Moore.
Yeah, I'm thinking it was, that may have been the last graduation, but that last year we finished out.
So 68?
Yeah. And then the next year I was at Robert E. Lee.
Yeah.
They started.
Did it feel, Ms. Kimball, at the time, like, obviously these things were happening across the country. Did it feel like you were making history at that moment, or was it just, taking care of your kids?
Like making history. It was just the thing that we had to do, and we did it. I mean, we knew we couldn't do and get out there, but we were learning to speak up, and we started speaking up.
Right.
So I started talking when I wasn't saying anything, but I learned to start talking. I mean, start speaking up.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of the mayor at that time. He told us we didn't need that building. Well, the seniors were going down to MLK, and they didn't have one room to eat in, and one room they had a lady teaching sewing, and there wasn't enough room at MLK. Well, that's the reason we start complaining, fixed up the Legion Hall. And that's how, we kept on. Bob Cunningham, I think that was his name, the mayor at that time. He said we didn't need it, but we kept on until we got it. And one of the ladies that worked for the city, she was right there with us too. She got another job somewhere else. But she went and spent all this money, bought everything we needed, the cooking utensils, the dishes, everything we needed at the Legion Hall, she's got it for us.
Wow.
Huh. And I said, that building was, we had dances, we had church, we had everything. That was our center. And they still use it as, they rent it now when people want to have a birthday or a party or something. And they rent the Murphy Legion Hall.
Yeah. Well, I heard you guys had an event yesterday talking about this project, and you talked a little bit about your work over the years with the Denton Women Interracial Fellowship as well. So can you talk a little bit about the different ways you've been letting the public know, first about the work that you were just talking about, but also about this archaeology project and your family's history?
Well, one of the fellas, our mayor's father, he was the one that he would speak out and do things that we used to couldn't do, but he would make sure. He came to the center one day and he wanted to ask me, can I use your picture? Well, I didn't know what he was going to do with the picture. I told him, yeah. And ended up, it was Miss Alice Alexander. She was our principal's daughter. She was a first grade teacher. Everybody that went to school went under Miss Alexander. Well, Fed ended up getting Dorothy Minna, Ruby Cole, Alma Clark, and Miss Alexander and myself pictures and put it on his building at their old Scripture Street. It was the year before they were saying your pictures out there on the wall. I said, what? But it was the year before I even saw that. Because I never didn't have to go that way to towards the hospital. But when he sold that building, they put it our pictures under the underpass, the walls under the underpass. And it's there now. But Miss Alexander and Dorothy Minna, they have passed on. But Miss Clark and Ruby and myself, we're still alive. And our pictures are under the underpass there. And as you come in off of Dallas Drive, and like you're going towards TWU, you pass by that underpass. And you can see our pictures on the wall on the underpass. Wow. So that was, I don't know, I've just been involved in city and whatever. And now I'm retired and they still won't let me retire, but I just get involved in things. And I guess the Lord just left me here for that purpose.
And Mr. Clark, what about you? What have you been involved in terms of like educating the public in terms of this project?
Oh, okay. I was going to say, I was too young for the civil rights movement. Just mainly, you know, the folks I know, a lot of folks that I know do the same things I like to do. And they just asked me about it and then expressed a lot of interest. I thought they want to know where the website is, what they can go see. Or sometimes they'll come up and go, hey, I saw that, and I forgot about it. I saw the video on that website, you know, where you told me to go. And I take the opportunity, you know, sometimes to talk about, you know, some of the history and some of the stuff that Aunt Betty was talking about and stories from my dad and stuff that he told me, you know, about those times before. And it kind of, we start off with the Tom Cook Project, but it tends to sometimes swing back to the old days in Denton and the things that, you know, people didn't do, couldn't do, weren't allowed, you know, just because of the things he managed to do in those times anyway, when he shouldn't have been able to. And it kind of ties in together. It just usually turns into a, you know, pretty interesting conversation about it. You know, it kind of gets away from the blacksmithing sometimes, but just more in the, it leads to Quakertown, which leads to the stories I've heard about the people that were forced out of Quakertown. And they, at one point, had to stand up and say, we're not moving anymore. When they did move them out, I think they came and wanted to say, well, you can't stay here either. And Daddy, I think, told me about, he didn't mention Miss Alma Clark, but her husband, I think, was some of the older men that when they came to say, well, you can't stay here either, when they started to clear out after they'd been forced out of Quakertown, with some of those that hid behind the brush piles and the twigs with gun barrels sticking out, while one guy that actually, I think, owned the property that had sold it to them, you know, came out and said, well, this is, you know, they said, this is as far as we're going. And the tough guys that hid their faces decided not to come back, you know, after that. And we call it Solomon's Hill now. And that's one of the stories I've heard about it. Because my dad lived, like Aunt Betty, lived through a lot of that. And like when she was telling about the school, I remember Dad and Fred Moore. He went to Fred Douglas. And he would tell me that at half, they could use the field out at Denton High. But at halftime, they weren't allowed to go in the field house. Regardless of how cold, rainy, nasty it was, they stayed. They would huddle under the goalposts at the end of the field. And if somebody had to do the number one or whatever, they just circle around so nobody could see them. And the guys that had to would get in the center, you know, and they'd go right out there. But they weren't allowed in the field house. And I'm thinking, how in the world could you be, you know, civilized and do people? But that was... You know, the time, and like I said, usually all that stuff typically comes up, and if I have a long conversation about it, a lot of guys talk about the blacksmith and they enjoy it and they want to hear the, you know, Tom Cook story too, and it usually finds its way back into the community.
Yeah, your family certainly has, it really shows a lot of different time periods. It's very, like, obviously Mr. Tom Cook with blacksmithing during Reconstruction, and then, you know, the storm you mentioned in 1909, Quakertown in the 1920s, I think it was, and the forced removal. desegregation in the 1960s. I mean, that's one of the things that's really special about this story is that it highlights, I feel like, so many different moments in Texas history. But like in a very, like you said before, with, you know, your family was very resilient and self-reliant. And so it's in a still a very like positive lens. It's really, I think, an important story to share. So I'm glad that you guys are sharing this story. And just want to say thank you again so much for taking so much time this morning to sit with me.
Through all of that, though, from the Tom Cook side, the Clark Cook side, from my mom's side, you know, the Daniels, Watsons in East Texas, they had to, that's another hole. We could probably go dig up all kinds of stuff. Goes another direction too. But I have never been told by my grandmother, my mama Seal, my grandmother in East Texas, my granddad, none of them, none of the old folks, none of the elders, even with all the hard times, the things they faced, dealt with, I've never yet heard them say, hate anybody. Yeah. They've always just said that, you know, nobody, you're going to run into it. It's out there. They don't deny it. And that, you know, it won't make you happy and you can't trust everybody. But they never said that, you know, it's because, you know, you need to, you know, hate people and not worry. I mean, not try. It's always been, it still depends on you to do what you're supposed to do. And so with the struggle, it was always still that, but we're not, but we're okay. I mean, I've heard my dad say, yeah, you know, we lived through those times, but, and I think I can say the same thing. We're still blessed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like, you know, oh, woe is us. It just, you know, that's the way it is, and we still made it. And don't let them tell you who to be. You know, you be yourself.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think that's kind of a perfect note to end on, right? All right. So thank you, everybody. And yeah, I appreciate all your time. Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultura Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.